Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is psychotherapist David B. Schwartz. Schwartz received his PhD in community psychology from the Union Institute. He is a licensed mental health counselor and has a private psychotherapy practice in Ithaca, New York. For many years, he was active in the developmental disabilities community, which included serving as director of the Pennsylvania State Developmental Disabilities Council. Following personal psychoanalysis and mentorship under Dr. Carl Berger, Schwartz undertook a second profession as a psychotherapist. He is the author of several books, including his most recent, called The Sidewalk Psychotherapist, Caring and Compassion in a Chemical Age. It was published by Dog Ear Publishing in 2014. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you began your career in the developmental disabilities community. What got you interested in that subject?
My first job out of college was working at Willard State Hospital.
Ah, yes.
And I noticed that what people at Willard State Hospital needed was to get out. And that was just the very beginning of the community movement for people with mental retardation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired by the Mental Health Association to start the agency that later became Homes Incorporated, this radical new idea of that people didn't have to be in medically supervised institutions. They could be on the commons.
Yeah.
And that's what grabbed me.
So eventually you ended up in psychotherapy, and it started getting you involved in wanting to be a psychotherapist. What was that? Tell us about that particular urge to transfer being analyzed to wanting to help people that way.
Well, first of all, I did not go into a psychoanalytic therapy because I was mildly curious about psychotherapy. People go to psychotherapists because their pants are on fire.
Yeah.
And so I did the same thing. I was suffering. I hoped for some relief. But in the meantime, I found not only that after years of this, that I had developed the ability myself to be able to do psychotherapy. And also my other discovery was that it was completely continuous with my life's work with people with mental retardation. It was the same thing.
Wow, that's amazing to me. I don't know if you coined this phrase about stubborn miseries. You talk about it in your book. Persistent misery, you say, is often from childhood sensitivities, childhood phases, and so on.
Yes, I think so. You know, when I got in the field of mental retardation, there had been a long tradition of medicine and psychology saying that people with mental retardation had something terribly wrong with them and they should be away in institutions.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out they were just ordinary people who had ordinary experiences that explained what they were experiencing now. And when I came back to the, quote, mental health field, I realized that just in the same way, although people were diagnosed with all sorts of things, if you actually sat down and asked them about their lives and asked them about what it was like when they grew up, it's immediately clear what their injuries are.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But a lot of people are under the impression that people who are retarded and have mental disabilities are not able to communicate particularly well. So how did you discern some of this?
I think one of the things that, what does a psychotherapist do? A psychotherapist does what a good friend does, which is shut up and listen and really be interested in understanding what the person is saying. And in that process, the person begins to hear what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because most people are saying, how you doing? They don't really want to know.
Exactly.
But if you really do, I think it begins to become clear. For instance, a standard thing that I will ask somebody new is, how much do you remember of your childhood? I find that I'm usually the first clinical person who has ever asked them that question.
Hmm.
But if a person says to you, really, I don't remember anything before I was 14.
Whoa.
You don't really have to look for brain chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's very explicable.
Yeah, yeah. And you say nobody comes out of childhood unscathed. all of us, in some ways, have been damaged or misdirected, perhaps.
If you meet a normal person in a normal family, please introduce me.
I actually haven't met one either, so I agree with you. Now, you say you're trying to get back to basics in your psychotherapy practice, and you think this high-profit world where people are just trying to make money are not paying attention to what their real mission should be, to sit and listen and to actually be there and present for someone who needs help.
I think so. You know, some years ago, my mother, who was a special ed teacher in Dryden, name was Louise Schwartz, she joined the Peace Corps and went up in the hills of Jamaica. And that was the time when the Nestle's company was pushing their formula to poor people. And she told me that what she saw was that the Nestle's company would hire local women, and then they would give them white coats and go visit new mothers and tell them about the scientific and medical advantages of formula over breast milk.
Wow.
And what this all resulted in was large profits for the Nestle company until worldwide outrage put an end to the practice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what they were trying to do was tell people, you know, your breasts that have milk for babies that's been that way the whole world, that's inferior. Don't use that. Use this modern scientific approach.
Yeah, I seem to have some vague memories of this.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, I think that really, as far as mental retardation, it was the same thing. People need, like, clinical things. They didn't. They needed the same things that everybody else needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see when people are diagnosed with mental health things, it really reminds me of the formula. In other words, the things that in our personal lives know help people, which is close personal connections. Maybe a psychotherapist who's very advanced in close personal connections, mm-hmm. that instead they're told you need the medical scientific solution. But when you look at the medical scientific solution, you find out that it creates great profits,
yeah.
just like formula.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So how has everybody been convinced that when they have a problem in life, it's chemicals in their brain? Not to say that medications can't be very effective.
And you do stress that in your book, that it can be a miracle drug for many people.
Absolutely, and I refer all the time people, if there's a medication that's going to help somebody, but that doesn't mean that they have a chemical imbalance in the brain. As Dr. Peter Breggin, really the world expert who is right here on Aurora Street, has written, that is all made up.
Yeah. And so when you try to talk to a psychiatrist who is incredibly involved and drugs are it in regard to his or her practice, how do you argue that?
Well, I don't argue it. You know, for instance, if I refer someone to an acupuncturist, which I do frequently, mm-hmm. let's say, or a nutritionist, the person is going to tend to see, you know, to a hammer, all problems are a nail. So the medication psychiatrist is trained to answer people's problems with medication. And I do refer to a very skilled psychotherapist. A skilled psychiatrist who actually has feelings for people. But what I stress to my clients is that just because we might find a medication that might help with the psychiatrist does not mean that you're flawed in your brain. For instance, if you have chronic infections and you go to your doctor and the doctor gives you antibiotics, they do not tell you that you have an antibiotic deficiency disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they're very useful. And so are psychotropic drugs.
Yeah.
But they don't take away a lifetime of child abuse.
I was going to say, you know, I mean, it masks problems in many ways. It treats symptoms instead of a whole life of a need to work out whatever it is that's going on with somebody. Now, the DSMV, the great manual that everybody uses to diagnose, goes out of its way to make everyday problems look like diseases. I have noticed that, too. Talk to us about how you feel about that.
Well, I feel about it. I'd say it's to make money.
And social control and, you know, authority figures telling people what to do.
Actually, it is, although when I was in state government and people would point out that a policy was wrong, let's say it wasn't helping people, I took the attitude of, no, it is working just right for what it's supposed to do. The thing you have to figure out is what is it really supposed to do as opposed to what it says that it's supposed to do.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so one could say that this whole attitude of the DSM-5, which even many psychiatrists, including the psychiatrist who led the last DSM, denounce as being really for money.
Yeah.
If you look at problems this way, you create a lot of opportunities to make money.
Yeah, I'm cynical enough to think that that's what's happening all over the place in regard to drugging people. You know, that 300 million people need flu shots, every single person over the age of 6 months. You know, to me, these feel like drug money-making schemes.
Someone once said, and I can't remember who it was, some doctor, the healthy person is not the one who takes the most medicine.
Smart. Smart idea. Now, you know, many people forget that prior to about the 1980s, drug companies couldn't advertise, doctors couldn't advertise. You talk about this in the book, how that has changed everything. I can't believe they give out samples to people without anybody supervising it.
Yes, why do they give out samples?
To get people hooked, right?
Well, you know, the way that I kind of think about it is that up to a certain point, doctors recommended things mostly because they thought they were going to help the patient. Now, after Reagan became president, he took away the prohibitions that really are in the Oath of Hippocrates. They go back thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
That doctors don't advertise, that doctors don't sell medicines. After that, it started to be an economic phenomenon, and people started being diagnosed massively.
Yeah.
But they weren't diagnosed so massively when doctors were just seeing people and trying to figure out just what was wrong with them.
Yeah.
You know, doctors used to say, take a long sea voyage.
Oh, yeah. Go take a walk if you feel anxiety. I've heard that in my childhood.
The physician I used to practice with in Pennsylvania, Dr. Richard Fried, had what I used to call the Fried prescription. He would say if someone were depressed, he wouldn't give them an antidepressant. He would say, walk outside in the sun about a half an hour a day and tell me how it works. And if it didn't work, then he would say, maybe you should talk to Dr. Schwartz. And he would walk him down the hall and introduce them to me. And I would say, what's the problem?
If you're just joining us, my guest is David B. Schwartz. He's a psychotherapist, and we're talking about his book, The Sidewalk Psychotherapist, Caring and Compassion in a Chemical Age. Now talk to us. You talk a lot in this book about your philosophy about really being present. And something happened to you way back when that made you feel totally present for the first time. Talk to us about your car accident.
Well, yes. You know, most people, and I was the same way, walk around in life with thoughts buzzing all the time. They can't really see the beauty of the world, the beauty of music, let's say. They're always thinking.
And worrying half the time, right?
Half? Probably all the time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And when I had this experience on Sanibel Island with my friends driving down the road, and then my friend made an error and pulled off and hit a tree, and it broke my arm. And I crawled out of that to the side of the road and sat down because the effect of the accident on me was to remove the veils from my eyes. I was transfixed. I sat there and looked at the mangroves, and they were greener than I had ever seen. And I looked at the blue sky of the west coast of Florida, and it was bluer than I've ever seen. And I didn't even notice the pain in my arm. And I didn't move until my friend John Hart came up and said, David, you're sitting on an anthill. You have to get up. And I said, no, John. Look, it's so beautiful. That's when I got a glimpse that there was a way to actually be here.
What do you think made that happen for you, though? Some people would say you were traumatized, but obviously it was an enlightening moment for you.
It was shock. But shock has been known in the very old asylums. They had horrible ways of shocking people, like tying them by their legs and lowering them down into a pit of snakes.
Oh. How many of them died and didn't live through that?
Well, but a lot of times a shock, as we all know from our own place, if someone dies, all of a sudden sometimes everything drops and you're just there. You may be overwhelmed with grief or sadness or pain or mm-hmm. something, but you're not thinking anymore.
Yeah, you're right you're in the moment.
You're just right there.
Yep.
And it turns out being right there is what we need from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And a psychotherapist is only a professional form of being right there.
Yeah, yeah. So you are in a state of being illuminated all the time when you're talking to people.
Well, I wouldn't bill myself as illuminated.
But how do you started on that path because of that trauma in many ways. So how do you keep feeding it? I mean, how did you learn to do it without having to be in a car accident?
Well, actually, first I had it with that. And then back in the late 60s, I had an experience on mescaline in the Ding Darling Bird Sanctuary, which was a day I can still remember as I can remember a few days in my life. So these glimpses made me go, there has to be a way of stabilizing this, of actually being here. And taking mescaline all the time is not going to be very helpful.
Exactly, exactly.
Any more than driving into trees. Well, it turns out that psychotherapy of a certain kind could quiet down the noise so that you could be more here. And then there are other things like Qigong and other practices mm-hmm. that are ancient, mm-hmm. that are just ways of what we could say being present in your body.
Yeah. See, it sounds like a kind of a form of conscious meditation where you're not just lost in your own silence, but you're able to be present in a meditative state and still be there.
Yes, that's true. I find myself that I am more able to be fully there if I'm doing it to help another person as opposed to whether I'm just sitting in the park.
Mm.
Well, you know, there's an old joke among psychotherapists. How many people need 7 hours a day of psychotherapy? And the answer is only psychotherapists.
You say in your book that you're convinced that technical training does not contribute to being a good psychotherapist. To tell us more, I mean, you obviously have had a lot of experience before you even became a psychotherapist. Do you think one does need to have had a lot of life experiences to be good at this and understand people's traumas and pain because you might have experienced them as well?
Yes, I think so. I think the whole technical project... this has taken place in many places. For instance, in agriculture, agribusiness considers growing food a technical venture.
Hmm.
Here in Ithaca, the new locavore capital, people who are running CSAs and the farmers market, et cetera, do not see growing food as a technical project.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are technical aspects of it. You have to know what you're doing. But it doesn't mean that you can follow the diagram in the book and actually come out with food that people will like and be good for them.
Yeah.
I think it's just exactly the same thing. We all know that if you meet people at the cafe or in the community, there's some people who you just naturally feel better after you've had a little conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those are the people, just like a person who runs a CSA. You can tell. You can feel it. Now, there may be certain techniques that may be very helpful, but largely, it seems to me, techniques are a kind of an illusion. If you learn this, I took a master's degree in a counseling program, rehabilitation counseling, in which I was taught all of the techniques.
Mm.
And it's very helpful to me because I always refer to that training about what is the wrong thing to do.
Ah.
Because technical training does not really do much for another person in terms of being there with them. And you can really see that more of it that's applied simply makes a person feel that they have a problem. The key is who the person is. And it's if it's a cognitive behavioral therapist, but they're there and they are the person, it doesn't matter what the approach is. I don't think.
Yeah, that's that. I thought that was really interesting. You talk a lot about that in your book. Now, you know, I have not heard this much, but you also bring up the fact that you believe much psychic suffering and healing takes place in the body. And a lot of people think it's the mind that creates pain and emotional suffering. But you think a lot of it's in the body, and I agree with you. I felt that during one of my medical traumas, that my body was speaking.
Yes.
And feeling more of the pain than my head.
Yes, I think that, I used to think it was in the mind. Of course, I was trained.
I was just going to say, all of us are trained in some ways to believe that.
Right. It's in the psyche. But it turns out, and there's, much practice and much research now to show, no, it isn't actually in the mind. Where is it in the mind? It's in the brain. For instance, I work with many people who have medical problems that have been insoluble by medicine. Mm. And I practice with a physician and I work with others. Now, why can a therapy make that intractable asthma or that skin problem or the chronic stomach problem, how does it make it go away? Because it actually is in the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if I am working with a person, let's say with what used to be called multiple personality disorder, which is a person who's been terribly sexually traumatized as a child, their bodies will change as we're working. Their postures will change.
Hmm.
Old wounds will start to open up on their skin.
Wow.
And then go away at the end of the session. All you have to do is look and be open to it, and you realize it is in the body.
Mm-hmm. And why it seems to me people aren't talking about that and certainly aren't following up on that in regard to helping people heal.
No, there are some. I think there's some people who know this. For instance, chiropractors are trained this way.
Mm.
Physical therapists are trained this way. I think nutritionists. There are other people, but there is always the danger of saying this is a nail. In other words, it's just in the body. It's just, you have this little thing in your leg, and if we fix that, it's going to be gone. Actually, it's like we're a hologram. The body, the mind, our feelings, spirituality, it's all one thing.
Uh-huh.
But emotional suffering, our bodies are what feel injury.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to feel it in our bodies until it's clear.
Yeah. You know, and I have a lot of friends in Europe, and they wonder why so many people, especially in this country, separate the body and the mind, you know? I mean, you can't get medical care, mental health care in the same place where you could, it's like a separate insurance and so on. That makes no sense to me, like these are separate entities. The way Western medicine treats the being, the human being.
Yes, it goes back to Descartes, doesn't it? Separation of body and mind. And it turns out he was wrong. What can I say?
Simple as that. Simple as that.
He was wrong. People are, the world is one thing. People are one thing. And we started thinking about a separation of body and mind. My father, who was a dentist, was involved in the early years of what was then called psychosomatic medicine.
Mm.
Now, what is psychosomatic medicine? I would say psychosomatic medicine is if you already have a split between mind and body, and then you just begin to notice in the late 40s and 50s that there's some kind of illnesses that seem to be caused by people emotional suffering, then you could say, oh, what a discovery. people's physical bodies are affected by what they feel. Let's call this new idea psychosomatic. Mm. Nowadays, you could just simply call it being a person.
Exactly, exactly. And more people need to do that. You know what I mean? It's not prevalent yet.
It is not prevalent, and I think that the reason it's not prevalent is because there is so much money to be made for things being the way they are now.
Exactly, exactly. I was just going to say that. Now you say toward the end of the book that psychotherapy is not a medical as much as a philosophical cure. To talk to us more about that, because you also talk a little bit about the spirituality of it.
I do. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I recently saw a person who had been in a hospital, and then follow-up hospitalization, and had been diagnosed really quite severely, put on all sorts of medications that didn't even match the diagnosis. I'm familiar with those. And when I said to her what I usually say to a person who's been in a hospital, "You've told your story many times, but I wonder if you would mind telling it to me again." Mm-hmm. The person said to me, "Are you kidding? You're the first person who's ever asked me."
Wow.
Now, years ago, even in a state mental hospital, people asked those multiple times, "What happened?" So it seems to me if one is operating from an idea that one's experience is solely produced by one's brain and that the chemicals in the brain are what affecting your experience, then it's totally, I suppose what you could say is medically reduced. It's a reduction. Mm. And the thing about that is there's nothing you can do about it unless a doctor can give you something for it. Mm. In fact, the idea of human suffering and its relief has been around since the cave. That in fact, as I use a quote by Epicurus, who says, there's no use in a medicine that does not relieve the sufferings of the body, there is no use of a philosophy that does not relieve the sufferings of the mind. And what is philosophy? It seems to me it's sitting together trying to figure out what's going on here.
David, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information so people can find your book, perhaps get in touch with you?
Sure. The book is findable in... it's on Amazon and all the other places books would be. It's in the Buffalo Street Books, our wonderful local bookstore. But very happily, it's also for sale in Gimme Coffee, Cayuga Street, which is where I wrote it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the height of success. A practical book on human suffering that the people in a cafe want to sell.
That's great. Well, David Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us. Again, his book is called The Sidewalk Psychotherapist, Caring and Compassion in a Chemical Age. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all the great stuff you do.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.